gets much too complex.
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and on KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California. This show is sponsored by no one. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org a week after airing. This show podcasts from radioforall.net, and you can contact us with ideas and questions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week we'll be speaking with Sunny, a resident of the Hombach Forest and resistor from the anti-development struggle against deforestation and the open pit lignite carbon mine in Niederzier and Elsdorf, North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany. We'll be speaking about the land there, the resistance, repression, and more. First, I'd like to make a few announcements. This week, Anarchist News announced online its awards. This week, Anarchist News announced online its awards for 2013, and The Final Straw received recognition by the site's administrators for the, quote, best anarchist audio, unquote, category. After a tip to the hat to John Zerzan's long-running Anarchy radio show out of Eugene, Oregon, the announcement reads, recently, out of Asheville, North Carolina, has come The Final Straw radio show and podcast, which has done a fantastic and consistent job of transmitting to a broader audience information about a wider variety of anarchist ideas. Some of their shows emphasize people like Sean Swain, Luke O'Donovan, C.C. McDonald, Oscar Wilde, and issues like nihilism, radical parenting, anti-civilization, modern slavery, the ZAD, or Zod, and groups like Anarchists Against the Wall from Israel and Anarchists in Spain. The certificate is to honor the work of Bursa Goodness, the named person behind the project, and their work at the Final Straw Radio Show. We appreciate the appreciation. For some of the other great English-language anarchist audio projects in production right now, check out thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org and click on our links to check out section. There you'll find an easy portal to such projects as The Circle Day Radio out of the UK, Crime Thinks the Ex-Worker podcast, Submedia TV's It's the End of the World and We Know It and I Feel Fine videocasts, Black Mask Radio out of CKUW in Winnipeg, Canada, Anarchist Dishes Radio Berlin out of Germany, the Bay Area's up-and-coming Free Radical Radio, and more. Check these out. See the hard work that these projects are doing to spread anarchy. Secondly, a reminder that AshevilleFM.org, the station that allows The Final Straw to be produced, is in the beginning stages of getting to broadcast on low-power FM spectrum here in Asheville. We have been assigned the number of 103.3 on the dial, but we're a ways from getting out on the air. There's a fundraiser on Indiegogo.com to help us get on the airwaves here in Western North Carolina. You can find that fundraiser by going to our website at AshevilleFM.org and clicking the Power to the Tower link on the front page for more information and a video on the subject. As part of the nonprofit industrial complex, be assured that you have the option of making a tax-deductible donation to us. Third, on April 12th in Olympia, Washington, there will be an anti-racist march at 8:30 p.m. from the corner of 4th and Washington. In some ways, this seems to be in response and reaction against the white man march or whatever it was called that went on in a bunch of stupid little places around the country. But yeah, check it out. There's information on the Facebook and probably on the Tumblr for the Cusp Info Shop. Finally, on Monday, April 28th in Phoenix, Arizona, there will be a protest against the International Police Conference at the Sheridan Hotel. According to the announcement, people will be gathering at 6 p.m. The conference occurs from the 27th to the 29th in Phoenix and will include pigs from Interpol, the South African police forces, Northern Irish police enforcement, and the disgraced ex-LAPD Sheriff Lee Baca, who was forced to resign earlier this year due to corruption and excessive violence in his jails. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We'll come like a wall! Lucasville 5. In February, Ohio Governor J. Wow Kasich gave his State of the State address. In it, he took the time to praise women who survived years of brutal captivity after being kidnapped by Ariel Castro. That case gained national media attention, and Jay Wow took the time to give medals to all three women. He described them as an example for their courage, for staying strong, sticking together, and literally breaking out into freedom. It was a pretty impassioned speech. If you heard it, you'd almost think that Governor Jay Wow believed his own words. Almost. You could almost think that Jay Wow found those women courageous and their struggle for freedom heroic, if he wasn't so enthusiastic about killing others who are equally courageous, whose struggles for freedom are equally heroic. I'm talking about Sadiq Hassan, Bomani Shakur, George Skates, Jason Robb, and Namir Abdul-Mateen, the Lucasville Five. These prisoners, along with Greg Curry, were blamed for leading the Lucasville Uprising in 1993. Since then, the Ohio Department of Retribution and Corruption has kept these prisoners on an irregular, draconian media ban in order to prevent them from communicating the brutal reality at Lucasville that provoked the uprising, and from exposing the irrefutable evidence that their false convictions and placement on death row are the result of a deliberate and calculated frame-up. They've been kidnapped, subjected to torture, and silenced, just like those three women in Ariel Castro's basement. But instead of issuing them medals,
all is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
But instead of issuing them medals, Governor Jay Wow can't wait to sign their death warrants. The brutal conditions at Lucasville in the 1990s were no mystery. I shared a cell at Mansfield with a prisoner named Danny Grimm, who won the largest civil award in U.S. history for prison brutality as a result of terror he experienced at Lucasville. When he arrived there, guards noted that Grimm had done time at San Quentin and wanted to prove to him that that didn't make him tough. They tortured and beat Grimm, along with the prisoner who was chained to him, a guy who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were tossed in the hold and left. Another prisoner alerted Shirley Pope of the Corrections Institution Inspection Committee. Back in the old days, when the CIIC challenged prison abuses, rather than shaking pom-poms for the terror complex, like the current cowardly regime under Director Joanna Saul. When Shirley Pope arrived at Lucasville, prison guards wheeled Grimm out to meet her in a wheelchair. Several of his fingers were broken, and he was covered in his own blood and fecal matter. Shirley Pope saved Danny Grimm's life. If not for her, he would have died in the dungeon at Lucasville. And that was not uncommon back then. Even other states knew of the murderous regime at Lucasville. The New Mexico Supreme Court granted asylum to former prisoner Timothy Reed to prevent his delivery to Lucasville, where he proved staff planned to murder him. My point is, the whole world knew that Sadiq, Bomani, George, Jason, Namir, and Greg were in the custody of a whole crew of Ariel Castro's. In fact, the world knows they were in the custody of a crew that was so brutal and sadistic that Ariel Castro could never aspire to their level of atrocities. That's what sparked the desperate event called the Lucasville Uprising. And because these men had the courage to, how did JWoww say it, stay strong and stick together and strive for freedom, after a prisoner population stood up to monsters worse than Ariel Castro, JWoww now intends to kill these heroic men. If Governor JWoww really believes in the principles he espouses, and if he isn't just a hypocrite and an opportunist with silly medals and platitudes generating a feel-good moment, he'll read Bomani's new book, Condemned, and he'll look at the evidence of the frame-up and the cover-up that followed, and he'll pardon the Lucasville Five. He can demonstrate a fraction of the courage that those prisoners have shown, and he can do the right thing, even if it's unpopular. And while he can't give them justice, he can at least end the injustice. Or he can do the politically expedient thing. He can kill innocent victims of torture and terror and go down in history as a bigger monster than Ariel Castro. To borrow a line from a song by Rage Against the Machine, until the ropes are removed from around these prisoners' necks, let there be no rich white life, we're bound to respect. Free the Lucasville Five. Go to redbirdprisonabolition.org for information and links on the Lucasville Five and their fight for freedom. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax facility. If you can hear the sound of my voice, you are the resistance.
The right to create a gradient race, the call to send me.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. to read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. Now to our conversation with Sonny from the Hombach Forest Resisters. Would you care to introduce yourself for the audience?
Yeah, sure, gladly. And thanks a million for having me on the show, Bert. I feel lucky to be able to say a few words on this program that I heard so many great things about. My name is Sonny. I live and participate in the Hombach Forest occupation struggle. It's located in the Rhineland in Germany. And I hope that all the listeners, thanks for tuning in, will not have a too complicated time with me, so to speak, for obviously English is not my first language, but I'm going to try to make myself comprehensible, hopefully.
Thanks so much for coming on, Sonny. I really appreciate it. Can you tell listeners about the Hombach Forest?
Sure, my pleasure. Well, the occupation itself started in April 2012, so we are 2 years old now. I try not to bore everybody with too widespread background information, but if possible, I'd like to state a couple of things. Just a stretch behind the forest, there is now merely more than a remaining strip of one of the once oldest forests in the wider area, the Hombach Forest. And yeah, directly behind it, there lies the Hombach Open Cast Mine, RWE. It's Germany's second biggest and one of Europe's biggest energy companies, is excavating carbon there, lignite, and this since many decades, and they have the official, meaning governmental, permission to clear-cut the whole forest and expand the mine. The carbon mine is a big problem, and therefore I'd consider it symbolic. It's not just local. 13% of Germany's CO2 emissions come from this particular mine, while RWE, the company that runs it itself, is Europe's biggest single producer of CO2. And the Hombach mine is the largest and deepest hole made by humans in all Europe. The fine dust pollution and the radioactivity that the mining sets free are enormous. 55,000 people, I'm willingly repeating this, 55,000 people have had to leave their homes, their villages, since mining began in this area, and 2,000 more will have to go in the next couple of years due to the expansion of the mine, not to even start covering the destruction of nature and what this means for animal and plant wildlife.
So you said that it was an open cast pit mine. Can you just, I mean, it's a pretty descriptive phrase for a type of mine. But can you describe what that looks like? And also, when you say carbon, it's the same as when in the United States we say coal, right?
From what I know, at least the British term is lignite. There is a distinction between charcoal, kind of more blackish coal, and more brown coal. That would be lignite. The open cast mine just means there's no digging underground in tunnels, but in the open. Therefore, it's devastation as far as the eye can see. The hole itself, it's 650 meters deep. We would have to look this up with the metric system. It's a freaking big hole. It looks like, you know, like we'd anticipate having pictures from Mars or somewhere. Wasteland, nothing really living or developing anymore. The machinery is humongous. It's the biggest diggers any place in the world. They're there at the coal mine. Even a huge car looks kind of really tiny next to it, and there's a couple of them. The directly surrounding perimeters of the mine, they're spraying loads and loads of water there because the groundwater level, due to the mining, is lowered to such an effect that there is no natural water resources anymore in the wider area. But to have a small rim of green that if you cross with a car, for example, close to the mine, that the view is shielded by a little bit of green. Yeah, they invest loads and loads of water to make this artificial strip around it. It's quite vexing.
If it's 600 meters, you said?
Yeah, 650 meters.
There's about 3 feet per yard, and a yard is almost the same as a meter. So I would say 1,800 feet, which is an incredible depth.
It is. It is really, really deep. Yeah, like I said, it's just a horrible sight.
Another thing about open cast mining or strip mining in the U.S. for coal is often it leads to, like, they use explosives to break out portions of the dirt if they can, and rock if they can't dig it very easily, which can cause rocks to fly for miles, hypothetically, and land who knows where. But often there's the dumping of the slag, all the stuff that they don't know what to do with from the mine. And you mentioned the particulates and increased radioactivity from that as a secondary effect of the mining. What do they do with what they've dug up and they don't want from the mine?
What they dug up and don't want? I could go into the numbers. I don't have them here present, but I could make a couple of clicks to find out the numbers, because they're digging up a lot. They're making an artificial hill with the, let's call them, leftovers. They call it Sophienhöhe, and are raving about what good it does for the habitat of animals, for generally the wildlife. So there is this big artificial hill. It's also, I mean, regarding the mine being the deepest hole made by humans in Europe, of course, it's the biggest, the tallest hill made by humans in Europe, too. So they put on a lot of things that grow quite fast. They put on plants that are not usually present there in the area, and therefore they are stating that the biodiversity of the new thing they established besides the mine, because of the mining, that the biodiversity is even better than what was there before. But I mean, it goes without going too far in the subject that a forest that has developed for thousands of years, that you cannot just replace this by a little bit of topsoil and some animal life and plants that you artificially put there. But of course, that's the official propaganda.
God, that's so idiotic.
You name it.
Sunny, can you talk about how this mining and deforestation has affected the communities around Hambach, how they relate to the project, and what resistance looks like among those who choose to resist?
Yeah, I'd like to. The local community is really torn. Many have given up hope completely, and they have turned from protesting or got even hostile to any mentioning of what happened and is still about to happen. But there are others, quite some of them, who support us, who are amongst us, or rather we are amongst them. And some of the local stories about the forest excite us ever so often. I mean, of course, there's the certain childhood gems about playing in the woods, getting lost, having all sorts of adventures. And then there's the stories about, I would call it monkey wrenching, maybe, intentionally, or rather just for fun. But stories go like, when there's a yellow cord in the forest and there's a loud carbon mine and you pull the cord and all machinery stops. We went so often and we had a lot of fun back then. That's kind of story we hear every now and then, and honestly, we have a lot of fun hearing those stories right now too. So there has been resistance, but I will come to that later, the whole conception, the whole kind of how it works with WE being one of the major employers there in the area makes it really, really complicated for people. I'll come to that later.
The German Wikipedia page for Hambach Forest talks about changes and developments that occurred in 1978. What can you say about 1978 in terms of the forest and in terms of the way the government dealt with the forest? And you've already mentioned that the government has officially given contract to RWE to do this mine. What did it look like beforehand? The relationship between the government and the forest?
The relationship is that kind of the government owns the forest, but the public, but it has to remain open to the public. This is still kind of the situation we have right now. So RWE now owns the forest, but it still has to remain open to the public. This gives, freakish legal situation that people like me, people like you, maybe people like the listeners, if they would just go to the forest, then there could be interference and hassle with some security guards. We think that people like us, we don't belong to the general public. So it has to remain open to the public, and it was like this almost all the time. But the situation with RWE now kind of cutting the forest up to its complete clear cut remains a vague kind of legal gray zone, because, like stated, on the one hand it has to be open, on the other hand they try to keep people who are a potential threat, whatever that might mean in their terms, who are a potential threat to the mine and to their plans there, they try to keep them out of the forest.
Who are the key players pushing for the destruction of Hambach? What companies are involved in the destruction? What government bodies? And can you talk about the connections between them, implicit and explicit?
As well, yeah. So I mean, RWE, the energy corporation, is the player here, plain and simple. And the government, of course. The part of Germany that we are talking about is North Rhine-Westphalia. And it could easily be considered kind of RWE country. The connections go back and they lie deep. But in general, like I said before, RWE is not only a, but maybe the major job provider, at least in the rural area. Also with sub-companies, RWE employs just a lot of people, and for the communities here, this means divisions and hostility that go as deep as to families. Some just take a stand for their jobs. They believe the propaganda of no alternative or just don't care. Others are shocked by the destruction of the land where they live in, where they live at, the evictions of houses and whole communities, the bad living conditions the mine put so many people under. And this division, we have examples of it being between parents and kids, between siblings and neighbors. Some fear even looking just in the direction of the camp, frightened of being ostracized or hassled. Others stand their ground and made and make their life about fighting the corporation. But in general, it's very complex and complicated, the whole subject there in the area. RWE just owns a lot of people. And yeah, this is up to how the whole thing sort of developed.
Many people here understand the effed up relationship between the destruction of the land we live with for the sake of privatized extraction, the complicity of an interweaving of government and coal barons, and the struggles of those forced to extract and destroy their own land base and those resisting the whole process in order to stop it dead. How do you perceive the Appalachian experience, and how do you find them to compare and contrast between what you see in Hambach and what you've seen in the U.S. South?
I perceive the Appalachian resistance from a distance. I mean, there is some contact, luckily, between those struggles. People associated the resistance here have been visiting us at the Hambach Forest in the past, but these ties, I feel, are far from complete. I'd wish for all of us to strengthen and widen these and many other ties to similar projects, definitely. And maybe also this radio interview that I'm able to give, thanks again, can help. No idea. But some of the statements I've been giving so far show that there is more than just remote similarities, but also contrasts that are visible. If you kind of you'd call a situation like this colonialist or imperialist, could be up for discussion. But of course, I think we all are pretty aware of the international connections, so to speak. Climate change, this destruction of nature and livelihood in the so-called third world means, a lot of climate injustice, a lot of people who have to flee from where they are because of the living situations. As far as Europe goes, if they try to get to Europe, they're incarcerated in gruesome camps on the borders of Europe by Frontex paramilitary units of the European Union. Yeah, I think, fuck, this is colonialism, this is imperialism, this is nothing but pure capitalism. Not the crisis, no exception, it's just business as usual, only visible at different places at different times. And I think, at least for me, in my opinion, this is the biggest similarity. That is just kind of some people, some corporations trying to make a big profit. Most of us in some ways trying to also go with the current, believing that there is no alternative. And some of us just, saying, no, we don't believe this. We just don't want this to happen. We just think it's wrong and we want a better life. Yeah, I definitely, on this level, without going too deep, I think there's a lot of similarities and things we can learn from each other, and a lot of solidarity, definitely.
Are there overlaps with other land liberation and anti-development movements in Europe and abroad? How does Hambach compare to the ZAD in terms of tactics and goals?
I don't want to say too much about overlaps, tactics and goals or the such, but I can definitely say as much as that the people know each other. Some might have participated here and there. Others might just be very solidaric and sympathetic from a distance. But there is strong connections and friendships, ties, love between different projects for sure. As a general we, homogenizing, I should not do that, but for simplification, I think that we all know what's going on just as a couple of examples, Lazat, like you stated, the NOTAF in Italy or the Roja Montana movement in Romania. Just to name a few, these are anything from just other projects. Quite the contrary. There has been, there is, and there will be exchange.
Can you talk a little bit about what sorts of plants and animals continue to reside in the forest, and how has the loss of habitat affected the populations? Like, you mentioned that there was the building, all the slag was being built, and then topsoil put on top of it to make a new hill nearby for all the woodland creatures to live on, but...
Yeah, I just have to laugh. You're just repeating what I said, but it sounds so sarcastic, so ironic.
Oh, how did that come out sarcastic and ironic? I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of life still, luckily, but not as many as there have been due to the destruction of already so many parts of the forest. Not all animals have now enough room to take care of themselves in their own ways, of course. But there are still some deer. Some few remaining foxes, boars, many different birds, then hares, rabbits, rodents, and of course many insects and spiders. There is even a certain kind of bat, the Bechstein's bat. I looked it up. That's also kind of the rough translation. It's also the official zoological name in English. Many zoologists fear that the Bechstein bat is facing possible extinction due to the ongoing loss of its habitat and the Hambach forest, the remaining strip being an important habitat to the Bechstein bat. Yeah, but the idea is Germany needs more energy. It's kind of the general public's interest is more energy, so let's take it up a notch and another one. So what is still left there will face destruction of their habitat. Either they are gonna get killed, they have to go to different woods in the wider area, or yeah, they maybe some of them will even retreat to the artificial Sophienhöhe. I don't know. Maybe they don't have any other choice.
You mentioned before, just so it's in my head, like not for the sake of the interview proper, but you said 55,000 people have been displaced so far, and another 2,000 will probably be displaced in the near future.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I can say something to that too, how the government is dealing with the whole situation. The plan of government and industry is the whole clear cutting of the forest and the expansion of the mine. But it's not only this one mine. So there's 8 more mines directly around this one. So there's 9 in total in the area. 4 of them are still active as well. So 5 in total are active and 4 have been closed in the last couple of decades. The Hambach mine itself that we are dealing with here is regulated until 2045. Up until then, RWE has the official legitimation, whatever, to do as they please. The plan then is to build an artificial gateway from the River Rhine to the mine, fill it up for, I would have to look it up, 5 or 10 years. They want to fill it up with water, and then having an artificial lake for recreational purpose or something like this. I wonder who's gonna swim this horrifying nuclear and whatnot lake of waste, but that is the plan. And the legal situation that we are dealing with here is that the mining law in Germany supersedes almost any other law. I don't want to talk too much about how much sense it makes to me personally that land can be bought and owned by someone. But if you do so, I mean, in Germany, whatever, we're living in capitalism, so people are able to buy property. Everything of value in Germany on this property or inside the ground still belongs to the state. So if there's carbon, coal or oil or gold, whatever stuff underneath your house, the government can, in the name of some greater good, in this case more energy, evict the people who are living there, evict you. And there is no real legal way to fight against this. The last time this law was changed was in World War II, in anticipation of more heavy machinery, fuel for the war machine being needed. The Nazi government passed some more parts on this mining law, which was pre-existing already. But so this particular law has never been changed again since then. So what the people have to deal with here is a law that was last time it was formed under the Nazi government in war times. This is not the most important, but I think it is still an interesting fact that kind of this mining law supersedes almost any other law in Germany based on World War II Nazi government laws.
Yeah, it's more so about the progression of the state and capital than it is about human life.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's definitely not something that's limited at all to Germany. I mean, America has its genocide and slavery and continued imperialism that it's standing on, but, you know, different circumstance, but same kind of stuff goes on here with eminent domain and the removal of, forced removal of peoples from the land base they live with and the poisoning of it. It's the same thing you see in China when they end up polluting whole stretches of land, building, I hate capitalism, civilization.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's the biggest bullshit. And yeah, like you said, definitely. If it's state capitalism or free market, whatever capitalism, it's the same. It's business as usual. There has to be destruction. There has to be profit made off of everything, of nature, of human and non-human animals alike. That's the way it goes.
Can you talk about, I think I kind of tried to ask the question before and maybe I've got like a better way of asking it now, but so things changed with the Hambach Forest in 1978. Was there a major push within German government and industry in Germany to start increasing extraction of resources like lignite or further privatizing public lands? Was there a push towards neoliberalization at that point, or did it just happen to happen at that date? Or in response to the petrochemical crisis that was going on with OPEC, maybe?
That's a very good question. And indeed, it has to do with the crisis back then. There has been increased interest in mining for quite a while. But what makes this question so important and interesting is also that, of course, there was a big decrease then. Germany has had excessive amounts of nuclear power plants, and the current government, that doesn't matter, like almost any other government as well, they were running with it and promoting it. The fun thing is that only after the terrible accident in Fukushima, there was a kind of complete setback on all of this. Everyone can kind of go to the internet, look it up. So RWE, for example, was for years raving about nuclear power plants, nuclear energy, and how they're sort of, this is not a direct phrase, but sort of pissed off with carbon excavation and with that it's so dirty and it's just a bridge technology and they try to get rid of it. And now that the government decided to go with the flow and not invest into nuclear energy anymore, nothing of that has been said since that point. Now kind of carbon excavation, coal power plants, they are good, they are perfect, they are clean, it's our hope, it's our future. So it's really so funny, not only the situation back then when there was a big promotion, but then there was an enormous decline. But now that nuclear energy is kind of frowned upon in the general public in Germany, now the government and all the big corporations are raving about carbon, about coal again, like all their other arguments never happened. But whatever, even this, I'm repeating myself, business as usual, we heard their lies ever so often. So, yeah.
In the United States, the natural gas industry and the coal industry over the last few years have done a really big job of trying to counter pushes towards, trying to fight against the rise of other industries like solar or wind or geothermal or wave powered that people have been talking about in the United States and trying to push the Obama administration into accepting. And so the coal industry has started advertising itself as clean coal, like, oh, well, it's okay because we've got clean coal, whatever the hell that means, coal that burns cleaner, or like if that means that they dump all these chemicals on it and then those chemicals get accidentally loosed into a river in West Virginia or what have you, like it's clean coal. It depends on the marketing, I guess. Coal is your future.
Definitely. It doesn't get any brighter than that, huh?
More with Sunny, an anarchist participating in a resistance to the destruction of the land in Hambach Forest, Germany, after this musical break. If you're listening to the show live on AFM, stay tuned at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for the rebroadcast of the most recent Slumber Party Slice Comedy Radio Show with Michelle. Welcome back to the Final Straw Radio on Asheville FM. We can also be heard on KOWALP at 106.5 FM in Olympia, Washington, KDBTF at 88.1 FM in Bodega Bay, California, and KXCF 91.5 FM in Marshall, California. We're back with our conversation with Sunny, a resistor to the destruction by open pit mining and deforestation of the Hambach Forest in Westphalia, Germany. Would you say that the resistance around Hambach is a struggle to save the last elements of a forest, or an attempt to reframe the forest and people's relationship with it? Is there a struggle to liberate the land for its own regrowth?
To that question, I would say yes and no. So generally, I'm trying to say some more objective things, but I can hardly claim on doing anything else here than mere subjective stances, of course. So if we'd be able to save the forest, it would be amazing. It has to happen, but the relationship between people and forest, I don't really have a clear answer to that. I mean, for many of us, the forest, the trees, the nature in general has become a more definite aspect of our lives. I mean, I myself have been living in larger cities for a good proportion of the last couple of years, and even though I miss some aspects of life and struggle there, I can now hardly imagine myself outside of some more rural contexts. So for me, it had this kind of effect that I feel much closer, much more acquainted to nature again. So it changed my personal relationship with the forest. If not in theory, then definitely in practice. The liberation of the land is a definite core of our struggle. So last summer, there was the climate camp and the Reclaim the Fields camp. Close by, it was a huge success. People from all over have been there. We were able to establish a lot of interesting stuff. It was just a lovely time. One of my main points of critique would be the fact that people have lost the opportunity to live off of the land. I mean, states and corporations sell and buy everything. Needless to say, ridiculous claims for energy, medicine, the whole industrial food complex with artificial food, the murdering of billions of animals, just as some aspects of the development of land being owned in this way. Portions of land being bought and sold, and some have the rights to do so, to exploit, to, let's say, use it, as they would say. Others don't. For me, this is all bullshit. This is all crap. Living off of the fat of the land, that would be an idea that I'd like. I mean, utopian now, maybe, but definitely an idea that was sustaining humanity for almost its complete existence. So I think there is a chance of looking back on how humans, how we, so to speak, did it. And the first step would be kind of getting back the land, just reclaim the land and do with it as you please in a kind of more ecological way, kind of more, basically down to earth, kind of for yourself and for the community, down with monoculture and all that crap. This would be kind of the first step that I would imagine.
You mentioned what your experience of living on the land in Hambach has been like. What's the community like among those of you that are there? Like, how does that feel to you, and how does it differ from how you feel in a city or a suburb?
That's a real tricky question, because on the one hand, there are similarities between all projects of more emancipative liberation kind, but of course, everyone is different, so wherever you are, it's different people and therefore different feelings to the projects. And even the same project might feel completely different during a span of time when there's different people there. But in general, I'd say the Hambach Forest Project is a really easily approachable one. Whenever people come, they are cordially invited to participate in whatever they want to do. They don't have to do certain things if they don't want to. There's no need, kind of, there's this and that chores and you have to participate. But most people sooner or later just take a liking in being part of the community. And though it is in the forest and on the forest front, there is always a lot of things to do. You can get involved on the first day during the first hours there. It is not only a project about preventing the clear cut of the forest, but of course also a platform for living differently. We try to live together. Of course, it's trial and error, but like I think most other projects, but we try to live in a way that we envision society could be, to live right here, right now, in a different way of solidarity, respect, mutual aid, autonomy. So it's a really good platform for this. We grow food there as well, do all this. We have some solar panels, but there is not that much electricity, so it's also kind of really interesting how we deal as sometimes a big community with all that. Water, like I said, there is no groundwater anymore, so water has to be brought in from the outside as well. We have generous, lovely support from locals, so this is not really a problem, but something that we have to do ever so often. So yeah, it's really, really interesting for me how this all works most of the time, just perfectly well. And one more thing I'd like to state, I have absolutely no problem, why should I, with terms like eco-activism or the such, but I think it would fall a bit short if we would consider the protest or the people there, like the media sometimes does, to be purely eco-activists. Some might feel like this, but others are just kind of, for them, the activism they do right now there is just one part of a wider anarchist or anti-capitalist struggle. And they would see themselves rather as activists in those fields, with a focus right now on where they are, because they think it's just as important as any other struggle in this direction, but not necessarily as being mainly eco-activists. So there is this variety of people and this variety of ideas what to do. And yeah, so there's just a lot of things happening, and that's great.
As someone who participates in the Hambach resistance, what do you have to say to other people's struggles that are trying to stop destructive, extractive practices where people live? How do you find that it shapes your... That's a weird question. I'm sorry.
I'll just give a weird answer.
Okay.
No, I mean, I don't really want to say much to other struggles, for I have the feeling that they sure know what they're doing. But I can clearly and loudly state that they have my, and I guess I'm free to say, all our solidarity and deepest sympathies from the Hambach Forest. I think this is mainly it. I think that my perspective on many things cannot be anything but an outside perspective, and there it should remain. And where we get involved, we fight. And yeah, I just love people who are doing things like that, who are getting involved in a life that is worthy for them living, a life worth fighting for, because you fight for yourself. This is to stop this machinery. Yeah, this is beautiful, and I just wish everyone luck and a lot of resources to do so, and to keep on and keep strong and keep fighting.
I really have to say that the choice of having a saw going on behind you as you're talking is it's an interesting thing that comes through the audio.
Yeah, we have to make up a even more incredible story about me just being cut from a platform or something while I'm giving the interview.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So you are currently resisting the eviction, and they're... Oh. So as we can hear in the background, the people of the Hambach Forest are very excited about and practice the skill of ice sculptures. Can you talk a little bit about what your comrades are working on in the background?
Yeah, like you said, ice sculptures, most and foremost.
You've mentioned that RWE is, along with the government, those are the two responsible characters in the extraction at Hambach, and these are the projects that are capitalizing off of it. Can you talk about, are there any other projects that RWE is involved with, any corporations that are related to it or subsidiaries, and about how people can support Hambach struggles by acting locally?
Corporations or companies related to RWE. RWE is 100% owner of American Waters. It's formerly American Water Works Company. And from what I got, it provides water for a substantial amount of people here in the US. Then there is something called Favorit Unternehmens und Verwaltungsgesellschaft, that apparently is something like a joint venture between RWE and ExxonMobil Yeah, this is kind of, this sounds so stereotype and cheesy, I guess, but yeah, I mean, all actions for a world free of oppression of any kind are connected. So I think no one should hesitate for solidarity action whenever they see fit. I mean, destruction, creation, people know what I mean, I guess. Yeah, don't if you want to do something, don't hesitate on how can I support this or that, because there's always things to do right next to you. That's what I basically want to say.
As we spoke this week, the Hambach Forest defenders were under the weight of eviction by state forces. From what you know of the eviction attempt of March 27th, 2014, can you describe it for listeners?
Yes. Somehow it did not come as a complete surprise to me, certainly not after the raid that was just 1 week before, even though there's no visible connection, for they did not find anything incriminating them. But I felt that, yeah, there's something brewing, like something nasty. You can see they try to tighten their grip and do some more stuff. On the other hand, I did not really expect an eviction. But it did happen in the early morning. The state forces came in with the heavy equipment, like cherry pickers and more heavy machinery, climbing squad. And piece by piece, they tore down and destroyed all the tree houses. And then they destroyed all the trees where the houses have been on as well. As far as I know, the two last remaining squatters, they were able to climb up high into the trees. Therefore, it took the so-called authorities quite some time to get them down. They might have even been locked on there. I'm not 100% sure as of that point. But of course, after several hours, the sheer number of state forces and their equipment was just too much. And finally, they tore the complete forest occupation down. The woods had been surrounded and guarded, and neither for the press it was easy or for the general public at all possible to really have access there. Some of us had been able to sneak by for a while, but the grip was pretty tight, so it seems like it was a long plan, and they had several hundred police there, and it was a big happening, at least for them, and for us it's not a new, but one more of those situations where we hopefully regain strength and just take it from here.
So they didn't off-script a little bit, but they didn't actually succeed in tearing down what remains of the forest, but just kicking out the people that were in the tree sits, destroying the tree houses, but still forest remains, right?
The forest remains. I think, like I said before, the mining will continue officially, as far as our information is now, up until 2045. And by then the forest will be, if everything works as they plan, will be long gone, but not for a couple of more years. So they're cutting parts of the forest all the time, but the complete clear cut, this will still take a while. The mine is not expanding at such a fast level. So there's still the forest there, or the parts that had been remaining, just the area where the current occupation had been, they did cut down all the trees there.
How are the resistors? Were many of them arrested, do you know, or injured during the intervention by the state?
I mean, injuries, brutalization, intimidation, this is always happening, but on levels that, in Germany at least, you cannot really do something about this. Might sound freaky, but it's just the case. So whenever you try to bring someone from the police court for unreasonable, brutal behavior, then you get a counter court case that you resisted and you were attacking an officer, something like this. So this is just business as usual in Germany, so there won't be really any moaning about that. This is what we're, for fucked up reasons, but this is what we're used to. As far as I know, the people are all right. They brought them down from the trees to police stations, took their identity and or fingerprints and such. No one was held in prison overnight, but court cases might follow. I do not know if those things as of today. There has been a situation of a rather semi-perfect nature, like having no info where some of the people have been brought to what police station. And after they finally had been released, there was not the usual welcoming committee of support and solidarity outside the police station for everyone. because supporting protesters get figured out where those people have been dragged to. So this is a regrettable and, yeah, stupid situation. But of course, it can happen. I'm just sorry for the people who had to wait a little longer for welcoming arms. They are, of course, as we all know or can imagine, highly appreciated. And yeah, so this is just a situation that with the number of people that are there with the information, you cannot cover all grounds at the same time. And with the camp, yeah, the occupation of Meadow is remaining. It is standing strong and fighting, and so we lost the forest occupation, which is a disaster, most and foremost for the trees that have now been killed, and for the homes of many people that have been destroyed, the tree houses, but the protest has still a home. It's going on far from over. Tomorrow is always another day.
Were any of the Bula injured?
Ah, yeah, the Bullen. Bull would be, if you refer to more than one. Not that I have no information on that interesting question. As far as I know, they were able to get up and down the trees. Aren't.
On the humbuckforest.blogsport.de website, there is a call to reoccupy the forest for April 26, 2014, after the planned skill-sharing camp. Can you talk about what was planned for the skill-sharing camp and how it's going to look different now?
So yeah, like I said, the skill-sharing camp is going to happen, and directly afterwards the reoccupation. We have a saying that goes kind of like, after the eviction is always before the reoccupation or before another occupation, and this is just the future as we see it. The skill-sharing camp is going to be on the meadow now. I mean, would have been on the meadow and on the forest occupation, so it's mainly on the meadow and wherever we want it to be, basically. Everyone can imagine the anyways always existent topics and things happening there, and somehow now partially more present things and necessities as well. We now can even share more skills and widen certain abilities. In general, the idea of it is to be as open as possible. So whoever presents ideas, wants to talk about other projects or forms of resisting or whatever that they seem fit, there is enough space for that. There's going to be some theory, but also a lot of practice, like how to build tree houses and build tree houses as well. Like I said, not just theory, insulation of walls, knitting masks might come in handy for carnival, for example. Then also kind of collecting wild herbs and stuff like this. And there will be samba workshops, action climbing, how to build tree pots, all those things. It's going to be a lot of partying as well, of mingling, of getting together, making music together. And yeah, in general, I just think it's going to be resisting, loving, preparing, and doing kind of time. That's going to be most probably very interesting. No one should feel like it's not going to happen. We are going to have a blast of a skill sharing camp, I'm sure. And with the reoccupation already out there, the authorities definitely think they're in a position of advantage, but they will be proven wrong. I'm sure of that. We're going to squat the forest again on the 26th of April. With the ties and loves, the friendships and allies we have, with the plans we have and the plans we can come up with all together, and all our mischievous ideas, of course. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the 26th of April.
And how can people in the listening audience keep up on news about the anti-development projects in general and Hambach Forest Defense in particular?
You already mentioned it, Bruce. There is a blog also in English that we try to keep as updated as possible. It's hambachforest.blogsport.de. I don't know, should I spell it or repeat it? Or
If you want to spell Hambach, that would be great.
It's hambachforest.blogsport. So this is not Blogspot. It's not Google. It's Blogsport, like in sports, .de. hambachforest.blogsport.de. There you should find anything that's happening, all the updates, upcoming bans, modifications, whatever. You can also see there have been messages and actions of solidarity in many cities and areas already. And of course, everyone is welcome to participate in whatever they'd like. We have seen banner drops, demonstrations, and know of other things which happened due to the wave of this depression. And there's two more things I would like to say. The second is a current development of unclear proportions, but definitely more than just good news. The first thing is something that I'm usually very reluctant of, but I know that I sort of have to do this now. On the side of the blog, there is, if you go to the blog on the right side, there is also a button where you can, if you have the abilities, if you have some money for solidarity that is not needed otherwise, where you find the bank account details. So the money goes directly to the occupation for climbing gear that has been lost, for the computers that have been stolen by the authorities, for stuff like this. Never for things like food or clothing or personal stuff, because all that we always get for free somehow. We all taken care of. So it's really for kind of the gear that we need to go on with the campaign. So if there are some people who would like to give a donation, you will find the possibility on the blog as well. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is that just yesterday there came in good news. One other mine in the area, I was talking about that there's 9 mines, 5 that are still running in general there. There's one mine named Garzweiler. Supposedly, like, the plans go running up until 2044. And there are several steps of so-called development. And the last step that was planned was officially decided that it's not going to take place. So at least one village near this other 9 is officially off the hook of destruction. They're still directly on the brim of the freaking mine. Doesn't really account for being happy about all the destruction that is going on. But this could mean a complete new reset, a new hope for the other folks here in the area. Once one mine stops, at least for one village, and we're speaking of 1,400 inhabitants here, it's so great, I'm so happy for them. And I just have the feeling that many more people are going to start to see the possibilities of other mines stopping now too. See that maybe again. And yeah, I mean, those are changes that we can make happen if we put pressure on the mines and make them as the least cost feasible as possible, so to speak. And this is really great news for me. There is people who don't have to leave, who are not going to be evicted, and this gives a new light on many of the developments that are going to come in the next couple of years and decades for sure.
That's really great to hear. Thank you for passing that on. In terms of the donation that you mentioned earlier, is there a way you would suggest that someone could make a donation without linking to their own bank account or credit card? I guess maybe purchasing a short-use credit card at a gas station, maybe, and then going online in an anonymous manner and making a donation that way?
I cannot say anything about the procedures for the listeners here in the U.S., how this might be working out. But yeah, maybe you can. I'm more than happy to also get some knowledge on that.
Yeah, I'll think on that and include it in the broadcast. But thank you so much for taking the time and talking.
No, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
We've been speaking with Sunny about resistance to development and destruction of the Hambach Forest for an open-pit lignite mine in North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany. More on that movement can be found at hambachforest.blogsport.de, and check out ashevillefm.org/the-final-straw for the blog post that we'll be putting up, including links to information about the other companies that are related to RWE, the company that is currently destroying the Hambach Forest. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and on KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California.